banners were being placed along the walls by a crew of imps, while in the centre of the room an enormous crystal chandelier with twisting, briar-like arms had been lowered till it hung a foot off the floor, and three gnomes were using long metal tongs to fix white candles into dozens of holders. Rourke stopped Kate beside the chandelier.
"Mistress Gnome?"
One of the tiny creatures turned. She was 3 feet tall, with a face wrinkled like an old apple. She wore a grey dress that went to her toes, and she had a faded red kerchief covering her head.
"This young lady is here for an audience with our master. Clean her up a bit, won't you? There's a dear."
The little creature set down her tongs, snapped at a female gnome who was polishing the floor, and seized two of Kate's fingers in her small, rough hand.
"I'll be seeing you very soon," Rourke said.
The gnome led Kate out of the ballroom and down a dark-walled, portrait-lined hallway, with a second gnome trailing behind. Kate thought that this was her chance to get away. She was, after all, nearly twice the size of the gnomes, and when they reached a staircase and the gnome matron had started up, Kate tried to jerk away her hand, intending to bolt down the stairs to freedom.
"Ah!"
Kate fell to her knees as the gnome bent her fingers to the point of breaking. The second gnome thudded into her back with both feet, so that Kate was slammed flat onto her face. The first gnome kept bending and twisting her fingers, while the other jumped up and down on her back, cackling gleefully. The red kerchief gnome peered into Kate's face.
"Now, Mrs. Big Shoes," she said in a high, squeaking voice, "are we going to have any more kerfuffle from you?"
"No," Kate cried as the other gnome dug her doll-like fingers into Kate's hair and yanked.
"Ah, but Big Shoes is all liars, ain't they?"
And the wrinkle-faced gnome gave Kate's nose a painful wrench. "No, I'm not lying, I promise."
"Humph,"
said the tiny creature, releasing Kate's fingers and nose and nodding to the other, who let go of Kate's hair and leaped off her back. The lead gnome started up the stairs, and Kate, her fingers, scalp, nose and back aching, followed obediently. She was bathed in a tub of scalding water, her skin was scrubbed raw, her hair washed. Her chewed-up nails filed down evenly. One of the gnomes raked a hard tooth comb through her hair, pulling at the tangles with such fury that Kate was sure that by the time they finished, her scalp would be bald and bleeding. They yanked her into undergarments like a dress, and then into a long-sleeved, high-collared ivory dress that had intricate lacework across the breast. And finally, one of the gnomes buckled Kate's feet into a pair of leather boots with dozens of hooks, while the other tugged her hair this way and that, in a complex braid. It was then the door opened and Rourke entered.
"Ah, no. I knew there was a young lady hiding under all that dirt."
The red kerchief gnome jerked Kate to her feet and dragged her before a mirror. Kate hardly recognized the girl staring back at her. In the old-fashioned high-necked dress, she looked like a girl from a book or a movie. There were pink blushes on her cheeks. Her dark blonde hair shone, and it had been pulled up and braided in a way that showed angles of her face that Kate had never known existed. She looked down at her nails and saw that they had been trimmed and filed so that the evidence of her constant worried chewing was nowhere to be seen.
"Yes," said Rourke, "you're ready to meet him."
He led her up another set of stairs. Unlike the rest of the mansion, this floor was quiet and still. She and the man walked along a dimly lit hallway, the wooden floor moaning under Rourke's weight, and Kate glanced out the window and saw that it was growing dark. Evening was falling, and it was snowing again. And then, halfway down the hall, she heard the sound of a violin. Kate stumbled, the heels of her boots folding beneath her.
"Steady there," Rourke said, and lifted her by the elbow.
This was not Rafe's song, the mournful, grey-toned winter song he'd played that morning. This was the song that Kate had heard on the Countess's boat, the one that was somehow both manic and haunting. It was the song that would play as the world burned. The Dire Magnus was near. An imp stood at the end of the hall, And as Kate and the bald man approached, the creature opened a door. Unobstructed, the music poured forth, and Rourke placed a hand in the small of her back, and she was propelled forward, as if she were dinner chucked into an animal's cage, and she heard the door slam shut behind her. Kate staggered to a stop. The violin was silent. She was standing on a narrow gravel path and seemed to be surrounded by jungle. All about her were oily, fat-leafed plants, tall, spiny-stalked palm trees, fan-fronded ferns, plants with orange and red and yellow and purple flowers clustered in tight profusion. The air was warm and humid. Kate glanced up and saw the glass dome of the greenhouse. The heat had steamed the panes, obscuring the world outside. The gravel path wound away, and a voice spoke from deep in the jungle.
"Come here, child."
Kate shuddered. She knew that voice. It was the voice of the being that had possessed the Countess. It was cold and ancient and savage.
"I am not accustomed to asking twice."
Very slowly, Kate stepped forward, her new boots crunching the gravel. She held her breath, tensing for her first sight of the speaker. Then, as she came around the bend, the jungle opened, revealing a gravel cul-de-sac at the end of the greenhouse. And there, surrounded on all sides by a tropical forest, an old man sat in a wooden wheelchair, a blanket across his lap. He was the oldest person Kate had ever seen, almost more skeleton than man. His flesh seemed to have been sucked away, and his body had begun to collapse upon itself, though his head and hands were both strangely, grotesquely large. His skin was loose and scabbed, and had a rotten greenish tint. He looked like something that had crawled its way out of a grave. He raised his lumpy head, and Kate saw that the old man's eyes were clouded with cataracts. He flicked two fingers, and a chair appeared across from him.
"Sit."
When Kate didn't move, there was a hiss, and she felt herself pulled forward and forced into the chair.
"Better."
Oddly, his voice was still the voice she remembered from the Countess's boat, full of energy and fire. But could this gnarled, shrunken creature really be the Diamagnus? Kate had built the Diamagnus up in her mind as a force of almost unimaginable power and malevolence. Not this shattered wreck with milky eyes. The old man grinned, displaying a mouthful of yellowed and broken teeth.
"You are wondering how this wasted thing before you could be the Diamagnus. How could he lay claim to such power, inspire such loyalty and terror? One might ask how a young girl, little more than a child, could contain within herself the ability to reshape time. One must not be misled by appearances. Power is power, while an outward appearance,"
he flicked his fingers again,
"is quickly changed."
A mirror appeared in the air, and Kate saw, staring back at her, a silver-haired crone whose face was so wrinkled that her skin seemed to be melting from her bones. Gasping, Kate raised her hands and saw her knuckles were swollen, her nails thick and claw-like. Before she could cry out, the old man waved his hand again, and Kate looked in the mirror and saw her face return to normal.
"Do not place your trust in appearances, child."
Kate's heart was pounding as the old man chuckled wetly. She tried to force herself to remain calm. Even if he really was the Diamagnus, he couldn't know anything about her. It was a century before they would meet on the boat in Cambridge Falls. She just had to stay quiet. She could get out of this. The old man cocked his head as if hearing some far-off tune.
"We've met before, haven't we? Or not yet, in the future?"
Kate said nothing. Was the man reading her thoughts? The old sorcerer went on speaking.
"The Keeper of the Atlas. Of course, I knew the moment you arrived in the city. I couldn't say exactly where you were, but I felt your presence, and how auspicious that you should be here this night of all nights. Tell me, child, do you know why tonight is so important?"
"The separation," Kate said, relieved to be talking of something where she could give nothing away. "The magic world is disappearing at midnight."
"Yes, we are going into hiding, ceding the world to the non-magical for no reason but that they hate us for our power and outnumber us 10,000 to 1.
Kate didn't know how to respond and so said nothing.
"They say, those who wish us to retreat, that the age when magic ruled the world is long past, that separation, retreat, hiding like scared children, is our only hope for survival. In part, I agree."
The man's wheelchair crawled closer.
"It is pointless to live on equal terms with those not touched with magic. We are not equal and never will be, but magic can rule the world once more. All that is required is will and power. I have the will, and soon, very soon, I shall have the power."
Kate had been thinking only of protecting herself, giving away as little as possible. Now, suddenly, she was beginning to understand.
"I foresaw this all long ago. I saw that magic would fade, that our kind would be swallowed by the rising sea of humanity. I tried to make others listen, but magician fought magician, elf fought dwarf, fought goblin, fought dragon. None would face the true enemy, and the power we needed was there. It had even been gathered together into one place, as if waiting for me to take it."
"The books of beginning?" Kate whispered.
"Exactly so. But the wizards of Rakotis, for all their learning, were fools. They had written the books merely to have the world know that they had written them, never to actually use them. Still..."
The old man wagged his monstrous head.
"The council was powerful. For centuries they were too strong to attack. But my day finally arrived, and I helped the warlord Alexander to conquer the city."
"You partnered with a lowly human," Kate said, unable to resist the jab. "I thought you hated them." The dire Magnus shrugged.
"War makes for unlikely bedfellows, and I killed him soon after."
"But you didn't get the books, did you?" Kate said. The old man moved his white eyes toward her, and Kate felt an invisible weight settle upon her chest. The man's face showed no emotion. The weight became greater. Kate was determined not to scream or ask for mercy, but the weight pressed harder and harder, and finally, while she still had breath, she cried,
"Stop, please!"
The weight lifted, and she gasped quietly.
"You are right, child,"
he said, continuing as if nothing had happened.
"The books had vanished by the time I arrived at the vaults of Rakotis. For 2,500 years I searched for them. And all the while humans grew stronger, and the magical world grew weaker. Now, what is the great solution? We will hide. Only I have not given up. I will yet find the books, and humanity will tremble. Your coming is only the first sign. Tell me, where are the other two books?"
"I don't know." He laughed.
"I don't think you're being entirely honest."
He crooked one gnarled finger, and Kate felt the magic rise inside her. She tried to push it down, but the man was too powerful. The greenhouse vanished, and Kate was somewhere else entirely. And then Kate barely stopped herself from crying out his name. She saw Michael. Fire swirled about him. He clutched a book with a red leather cover. She knew she wasn't really there, that Michael couldn't see her. Then, just as quickly, Kate was back in the greenhouse. She felt the magic settling inside her.
"You see, child, you do know. That was the Chronicle, the Book of Life. And holding it, your brother?"
Kate gripped the arms of her chair and said nothing.
"We will look into this later. We have other, even more pressing matters."
His wheelchair crept forward another inch, and the man brought his giant head close.
"For the separation is not the true reason why tonight is significant. Tonight is significant,"
and again he showed his jagged yellow grin,
"because I am going to die."
What? It was all Kate could manage to say. She was vaguely aware of a large red snake slithering through the jungle to her right. The old sorcerer chuckled.
"You're surprised. Perhaps you thought the Dire Magnus was immortal, but death is the sea to which all water flows. Elves might live for thousands of years, dwarves a few hundred. Wizards and witches are too close to humans. We might survive a century or two. After that, if we wish to continue living, we must resort to more forceful measures. As you see me here, I am 341 years old, and tonight, finally, I will die."
"But I don't understand. I met you in the future."
"You met me, yes, and yet you met another. What happens when a king dies? A new king rises to take his place, taking on all the titles and powers of the old, wrapping himself in the dead man's office. The Dire Magnus is one man, but also many men. I am the ninth Dire Magnus. I was chosen as a young boy. I had no knowledge of who I was, what my destiny would be. I was called, and when I awoke to myself, I took on not just the title of the Dire Magnus, but also the powers and memories of the eight who preceded me. Just as when I die tonight, I will also be reborn, as I pass on my power and memories to my successor. He will carry us all forward. He will be the greatest of us, the most powerful. He will also be the last. It will fall to him the duty of turning the world back as it is meant to be. And he will not fail."
Kate shook her head. The heat in the room was making her thick-headed. "There's another? Another Dire Magnus?" Even as she asked the question, a terrible thought occurred to her, and she felt a stab of dread. "Who is he?"
"A boy. It is always a boy. He is ignorant of his power, ignorant of his destiny, but there is power in him even now. Others will feel it."
Kate couldn't breathe. The heat and moisture in the room were choking her. She wanted to rip away the collar of her dress. It wasn't possible. It couldn't be possible. The old sorcerer went on speaking.
"It has taken years to track him to this city, and still some magic cloaks him from my view. Rourke has hunted the void the length and breadth of the island, yet he continues to elude us. No doubt whoever is hiding him thinks they are protecting him."
He waved his hand, brushing the matter aside.
"It matters not. The boy will come to me tonight. He will be drawn here. He cannot escape his fate. He will come, and the chain will not be broken."
Kate felt herself gripping the arms of her chair as if she might tumble forward.
What's his name?"
The ancient creature smiled, and Kate sensed that he had been waiting for this moment.
"You ask that, child, but you have already met him. His presence is all around you. I felt it the moment you entered."
The old man's milky eyes cleared, and Kate stared in horror, for they burned the same shade of emerald green she had seen that morning as Rafe had brushed soot over her cheeks.
"He will come,"
the old man hissed.
"He will come, and the Dire Magnus will live again."
Kate was aware of the imp entering the greenhouse and lifting her out of the chair. She heard the old Dire Magnus say,
"Take her to a room and watch her. She will be my guest at tonight's ceremony."
She felt the cold air as she entered the hallway. At the head of the stairs, she heard Rourke's brogue,
"Here now, I'll take the lass."
And she was passed from the imp to the huge man. And then she heard shouting coming up the stairs, and she was pulled out of her daze, for the voice that was shouting below was Rourke's. And yet Rourke was standing beside her, and the imp seemed to notice the strangeness as well, and then, without warning, Rourke kicked the imp hard in the chest so that he flew crashing out of the window. Then there were boots pounding up the stairs, and Kate saw a shimmer in the air in front of Rourke, and suddenly, standing beside her, was not Rourke at all, but Rafe.
"So much for that," the boy said. "You feel like running."
Chapter 15. The Book of Life. Michael woke, saw blue sky above him, and for one perfect moment had no idea where he was. Then a face appeared, upside down, leaning in very close to his own.
"How do you see out of these? They make everything so fuzzy."
Instantly, Michael was on his feet. He took in the blurred outlines of the forested valley, the snow-covered mountains, the volcano, the ruined tower. "Okay," he thought as his heart galloped in his chest. "Okay, I know where I am." Then his hand went to his throat, and he felt the bump of the glass marble still hanging from the rawhide strip about his neck. Reassured, Michael reached up to adjust his glasses, and realized he wasn't wearing glasses, that they were being worn by the figure in whose lap his head had been resting just moments before.
"You don't really need these awful things, do you?"
The elf girl had taken off his glasses and was holding them as one might hold a particularly slimy piece of seaweed.
"You look so much better without them, except for your nose. Were you in an accident?"
"What?
No. Or cursed by a wizard?"
"No."
"So you were born with that nose? I suppose after we're married, I'll just make a point of not looking at your face too often so that it doesn't frighten me."
Michael was still groggy from sleep and struggling to get his bearings, not to mention that what the elf girl had said was so utterly horrifying, and he had no idea how to respond. He simply said, "Can I please have..." then cut himself off. "Wait, where's Emma? Where's my sister? And where's the Chronicle?"
"Your overly large friend carried her downstairs, and he took that annoying book with him, as if I ever want to see it again. Ooh la.
Gabriel, he's okay?"
"Perfectly fine. Shall I throw these away, then? We're agreed?"
She dangled the glasses off the side of the tower.
"No, I need them, please."
"Oh, very well."
The elf girl skipped over and handed Michael his glasses.
"To the rest of the world you may be terrifying to behold, but to me you will always be the most handsome man alive, provided, of course, I periodically look away from your face."
She curtsied.
"Princess Wilhelmina, at your service."
"You're a princess?"
Well, of course. Why do you think I wanted my crown back so badly?
She touched the gold circlet now around her brow.
Don't you think it becomes me?
What? Oh, sure. Lots. With his glasses on, Michael could finally see the elf girl clearly. She was a perfect living duplicate of the ice sculpture. Her hair, he decided, was the color of morning sunlight. Her eyes were bluer than a cloudless summer sky. Her nose, bluer than a cloudless summer sky, Michael thought. What's wrong with me? She's got blonde hair and blue eyes. That's it. But even then, Michael heard himself comparing her voice to birdsong, the whiteness of her skin to new snowfall. Stop it, he told himself. You're being duped by some elf magic, is all.
Oh, wonderful, the elf girl clapped her hands. You've already fallen in love with me.
I have not.
Don't be silly. You should see the ridiculous look upon your face. By the way, have you noticed the way my hair moves?
Listen, Michael said with as much sternness as he could muster. I need to know you're not going to turn back into a dragon. You're not, are you? At this, the elf princess grew somber and reached down to pick up the severed gold bracelet from where it lay amid the rubble. Michael saw that the bracelet had shrunk down to person size, but even so, it looked large and bulky in the elf maiden's delicate hands. Wilhelmina ran her fingers over the cut made by Michael's knife.
It was almost 200 years ago when I came upon Zambertus in the forest. He offered me this bracelet as a symbol of the friendship between the Order and my people. I had no knowledge then of the atrocities he'd committed. So I accepted the gift and became his slave. 2 centuries of darkness and fire. A prisoner in my own horrible body, but no more. The dragon is dead and I am saved, all because of you.
She gazed up at him with tearful, adoring eyes, and Michael thought, poor thing, she's had a rough time of it. Then he thought, her hair really does move all by itself. The elf princess clapped her hands in delight.
Oh, you are in love with me.
What?
No, I just... Yes, you are my own rabbit.
Please, don't call me rabbit.
Bunny.
And she leaped forward and kissed him on the cheek, causing Michael to stumble back. Don't do that either. I'm serious. He could feel his cheeks burning and a tingling where she'd kissed him.
True, she said. There'll be plenty of time for kissing later. Oh, yes, indeed.
Enough of this elf nonsense, Michael thought. I want to see my sister, now. They found Emma in the guardian's quarters, a low-roofed building tucked along the back wall of the fortress. The furnishings were spare, a wooden chest, a cot, a stool, a table, but considering the guardian's own fairly filthy appearance, the room was surprisingly clean and tidy. Gabriel had laid Emma on the cot and covered her with several blankets, and when Michael and the elf princess entered, he was sitting beside her, holding her small, lifeless hand in both of his. Michael had the impression that Gabriel had been sitting like that without moving for hours. Gabriel, whose head was wrapped in a bandage, rose and embraced him.
I am very proud of you.
Oh, well, you know,
Michael was suddenly tongue-tied.
It's no big, well, you know.
Then Michael tried to return Gabriel's knife, but the man refused to take it.
You have earned it. King Robbie would agree.
Michael thanked him and slid the knife back into his belt. The red leather book was on the table beside the cot. Michael had felt its pull the moment he'd entered the room, and his hands itched to hold it. But as he took Gabriel's place on the stool, he gave all of his attention to Emma. Save for the fact that she was lying down and covered with blankets, she appeared exactly as she had the night before. Her eyes stared out at nothing. There was the same crease of anger on her brow. Her mouth was still slightly open. Michael picked up the clenched hand that rested on the outside of the blanket. It was as cold as a stone.
"It's okay," he said silently. "I'm here now."
And only then, finally, did he turn to the book. It was both smaller and fatter than the Atlas. In size and shape, it reminded him of the Dwarf Omnibus, a book Michael considered to have near-perfect proportions. As Michael had predicted, the Chronicle showed no signs of having been submerged in a pool of lava. Indeed, it was in far better shape than the Omnibus, whose black leather binding was scarred and worn with age. Michael did find, however, that a design had been carved into the leather cover. He couldn't say what it was for sure, but the network of ripples and whorls made him think of tongues of flame. For a moment, Michael wondered about the significance, then filed the question away and turned his attention to the most intriguing and unusual aspect of the book. Two metal hooks, fixed along the edge of the back cover, were clutching what looked like an old-fashioned pen. It was 4.5 inches long, smooth and slim, and it tapered to a point at one end. It appeared to be made of bone.
"What is this?"
"That's the stylus."
Princess Wilhelmina was standing behind him, and even with his back to her, Michael was frustratingly aware of her presence and of the fact that her hair smelled of springtime and honey and...
"Focus," he told himself.
"What do I do with it?"
"You silly. That's how you get the Chronicle to work. You write in the name of whomever you wish the Chronicle to fix upon, and voila, the thing is done. Is that helpful?"
"Yes," Michael said.
"Actually, it is. Thank you. Is it worth a kiss, perhaps?"
Michael ignored that. He snapped the stylus out of the brackets. It was very light. It felt almost hollow. "And now I just write Emma's name in the book. It seems so easy." The elf girl laughed.
"Do you even know what the Chronicle is, you rabbit, you?"
"I told you..."
"Hush! You're about to learn something. The Chronicle is a record. You could even say the record of all living things. Any creature that walks or talks or breathes or sings or laughs or cries or runs or blows bubbles..." "Oh, I do like blowing bubbles..." "...is listed in its pages. And the list is constantly changing as the lives around us bud and wither. By writing someone's name in the book, you add them to the scrolls of the quick.
But Emma's already alive. She's just frozen."
"As I was about to explain, the Chronicle is first and foremost a record. But the stylus allows you to focus the power of the book, the power of life itself, upon a specific being. Either to call them into existence or, and think now of your dear sweet sister, to heal them. But all you have to do is write the name down with your little rabbit hand."
And then Michael heard her whisper to Gabriel.
"He doesn't like me to call him rabbit, but I do it anyway because he's such an adorable rabbit. Don't you agree?"
Gabriel gave a noncommittal grunt. Michael opened the book. He was not surprised to find the pages blank, although, unlike the Atlas, whose pages were smooth and white, these were rough and marked with tiny splinters of wood. Michael flipped through to the middle and flattened the book on his knee. He paused. He had the sense that this was one of the shining moments of his life. To get here, he'd triumphed over great odds and great danger. He imagined Dr. Pym learning of what he'd done, or Kate, or King Robbie, or even one day his father. As Michael set the tip of the stylus to the page, a smile creased the edges of his habitually serious face, and, with a confident stroke, he wrote his sister's name. Nothing happened.
"Rabbit."
"What?"
Michael said irritably. "You will need ink. The letters won't just magically appear."
"Well, you could have told me that. Does the Guardian have any..."
"Ooh, you don't use normal ink."
The elf princess came forward and took his thumb in one hand and the stylus in the other. Michael was about to ask what she was doing, even as he marvelled at the rose petal softness of her skin, when she jabbed the sharp point of the stylus into his thumb.
"Ow! Don't be a baby, bunny. Here, you see."
And she dipped the stylus into the drop of blood welling on the pad of his thumb.
"Not only does it function as ink, but the blood also forges the connection between you and the book. A bit gruesome, but very effective. Now, wake up your poor sister. We'll all go outside, and I'll let you braid my hair."
Michael said nothing about this last suggestion, though a small voice in his head thought it sounded wonderful, but took a deep breath, gave one final glance at his sister's motionless face, and touched the stylus to the page. He jerked upright. It was as if he had jammed a fork into an outlet. An electric current was coursing up the stylus, along his arm, and out through his entire body.
"What's happening?" he heard Gabriel demand. "Is he in danger?"
"No, he's linked to the conicle,"
the elf princess whispered.
"Watch."
It seemed to Michael as if all of his nerve endings, from the tips of his fingers to his earlobes, down to the bottoms of his feet, were humming. After the initial shock, the feeling was not painful or even unpleasant, and as Michael began to relax, he realized that his senses had become almost supernaturally keen. He saw flecks of gold he'd never noticed in Emma's eyes. He smelled the faint, oatmeal-y odor of the soap they used at the orphanage in Baltimore. He even heard, though this seemed impossible, the soft, fluttery beating of her heart. He began to write, and the letters smoked and bubbled as he laid them down, as if he was somehow soldering his sister's name into the pages of the book. And then Emma lurched upward, shouting, "You'd better not—" She stopped and looked about, saying, "How did—" And a loud and joyful chaos broke loose all around her. Gabriel swept her up in his arms. Wilhelmina clapped and kissed Emma, declaring that she was so happy that they were to be sisters. And Emma said, "Who are you? Where's that dragon?" And in the midst of this, only Michael was silent, sitting there on the stool, his hands trembling as he closed the book, his face bled white with fear.
"So there I was in the clearing, and this big, stupid dragon—"
Emma glanced at Wilhelmina.
"Sorry."
"Oh, la."
The elf princess waved her hand.
"It's nothing. We're family, after all. Or we soon will be."
"Huh? Skip it," Michael said.
"Well, then we flew over the forest," Emma went on, "which was actually kind of cool, and landed on the tower, and that hairy, smelly guy jabbed me with a needle, and next thing I knew, I was here."
Here being the guardian's quarters, where they were all still gathered. Emma had just been told, partially by Michael, but mostly by Gabriel and Wilhelmina, everything that had transpired since she'd been frozen. How Michael and Gabriel had tracked her to the fortress, how Michael had gone into the volcano alone, how the guardian had tried to murder them, how Michael had figured out that the dragon was really the elf princess, how he'd managed both to lift the curse and retrieve the chronicle.
"The rabbit was quite extraordinarily brave," Wilhelmina had said.
"What rabbit? There's a rabbit?"
"She means me,"
Michael had said glumly.
"He was willing to lay down his life for you. Imagine a little rabbit like that standing up to a dragon with only a puny dwarfish knife."
Michael had felt everyone staring at him, and he quickly asked Emma to tell her story. When she was done, Gabriel announced it was time to think about leaving.
"It is a long journey back to the plane, and we will be hard-pressed to arrive before nightfall. Still, we cannot walk on empty stomachs. How much food is kept in the fortress?"
"Oh, quite a bit," the elf princess said. "I can show you."
Sensing his chance to escape, Michael said that while she and Gabriel did that, he was going to try and wash the mud out of his hair, and he hurried out the door. Michael went directly to the keep. Slivers of light stretched across the floor of the chamber. The guardian sat, lashed to a column, his hands tied behind him, his chin resting on his chest. Michael stopped a few feet away. He was trembling. He had kept himself together ever since Emma had woken up, knowing he could come here. "I need you," he tried to keep his voice from shaking. "I need you to tell me how to use the Chronicle. Princess Wilhelmina tried to tell me, but she must have missed something or not known it. I need to know what I'm doing wrong. You know. I know you do." Slowly, the man lifted his head off his chest and looked at Michael. Amazingly, he seemed even more ragged and wretched than before. His eyes were bloodshot, his hair was matted with dried blood, and his tunic was ripped open at the shoulder. But upon seeing Michael, he smiled. "So you use the Chronicle to bring back your sister. What happened, boy? I want to hear all the details." "Just tell me how to use it. I have to know, please." "You don't want to say. Fine, I will. For a moment you were connected to your sister. Her heart became yours. Anything she's ever felt, you felt. And I'm guessing that you didn't like it, did you?" His tone was gleeful, and what he described was exactly what Michael had experienced. He had felt the power of the book rising and rising, but he'd been entranced, enchanted, and by the time he'd finally realized what was happening, it had been too late. Like a swimmer who finds himself in a strong current and can only watch the shore recede, Michael had been carried out to sea. Or rather, he'd been carried toward Emma. Just as the guardian had said, her entire life had opened before him. Not just her life, but her heart. He'd understood what it had been like growing up as the youngest sibling, with no memories at all of their parents, no memories of a life that didn't involve moving from orphanage to orphanage, no family but him and Kate. He'd understood, at a level he never had before, that he and Kate were Emma's entire world, that Emma, the bravest person he knew, was completely governed by fear, the fear that she would, somehow, some way, lose her brother and sister, and then be utterly alone. And Michael had felt how, when he'd betrayed her and Kate to the Countess, the slender foundations of her world had been destroyed. And he'd understood how much it had cost her to forgive him, to trust him again, but how that sense of certainty she'd once felt, knowing that her brother and sister would always be there, had never returned. "Just tell me," he said, wiping the tears from his face, "what I'm doing wrong. What you're doing wrong? The only thing you're doing wrong, boy, is imagining that you're the keeper." The man leaned forward, furious now, straining against his bonds. "The Chronicle forms a connection between you and whoever's name appears in the book. That person's life, however awful, however terrible, however painful, becomes your life. What they feel, you feel. That is the way it is. But that's not fair," Michael cried, knowing he sounded like a child, but not able to stop himself. "The Atlas just takes you through time. Why can't—" The man laughed. "It is the book of life, and life is pain. The true keeper must be able to bear the pain of the world. Is your heart that strong, boy? I don't think so. You can scarcely carry your own pain, much less anyone else's. The moment I saw you, I said, this boy hides from life. He's doing everything to run away from pain, but there's no running away from the book." The guardian spat, and the look on his face was pure scorn. "You wanted the Chronicle. It's yours, but you're not the keeper." Michael found a barrel of water along the side of the keep and dunked his head again and again, scrubbing at the hardened bits of mud still stuck to his hair and scalp. When his hair was as clean as it was going to get, he dried his face on his shirt and leaned against the barrel, taking long, slow, deep breaths. "Michael." Quickly slipping on his glasses, Michael turned about. It was Emma.
I was looking all around for you. Sorry, he said. Are you mad at me?
What?
I just thought you might be mad at me, you know, for not listening to you last night and getting caught.
Of course not.
No, how could you think that?
Water dripped from his hair onto the lenses of his glasses, but Michael saw Emma clearly, with her muddy hair and dirt-streaked face. She looked small and uncertain.
Only you didn't seem all that glad to see me, and then you just kind of ran away, and I can't believe the things you did.
Her eyes were shining with tears.
You fought a dragon for me, and I didn't say it before, 'cause it's none of that elf girl's business, but I'll never, ever forget what you did. Never. And if you're mad...
Emma, I'm not mad at you. I just...
And he knew he had to say something, so he chose something that at least was true.
I was scared. I'm sorry.
Emma let out a sob of relief and rushed at him, seizing him in a fierce clench.
I'm sorry, too. I should have listened to you.
They stood like that for several seconds, and Michael, who just barely succeeded in stitching himself together, thought he might break apart all over again.
Be strong, he told himself. You have to be strong.
Finally, Emma stepped away, wiping her eyes with the back of her hand.
Hey, wait for me, okay?
Moving past him, she went up on tiptoe and leaned over to dunk her head in the now cloudy water in the barrel. It was mid-morning, and the sun was bright and warm. Michael could feel his own hair drying. Already he was telling himself that he would never use the Chronicle again. It was enough that they'd kept it from the dire Magnus. When Emma was finished, she shook her head, spraying water in all directions.
Hey, Michael.
Yeah?
Can I see the book?
Michael only hesitated a second, then went to his bag and pulled the Chronicle from where it was nestled beside the dwarf omnibus. He stood there quietly as Emma flipped through the pages.
Where's my name? I thought you wrote my name.
It disappeared.
And you really used your own blood as ink?
Yes.
Gross. And this is the pen thing?
The stylus.
Huh.
Emma ran her hand over the ripple design on the cover and handed the book back. Without looking at it, Michael slid the Chronicle into his bag and slipped the bag over his shoulder, feeling its weight settle against his hip. He let out the breath he'd been holding.
So, is it yours? Like how the Atlas is Kate's?
I guess so.
That must mean the next one's mine. I hope I don't have to write in it with my own blood. I mean, no offence, but bleh.
Michael thought about telling her that the next book was the Book of Death, then decided that that information could probably wait.
Michael, honest, are you sure you're okay?
He looked at Emma, her damp hair sticking up all over her head, and thought, she's alive. Whatever the cost, it was worth it. He said,
I'm fine.
And he managed something like a real smile.
Can I ask one more question?
Sure.
Then Michael saw a familiar, mischievous sparkle in Emma's eyes, and he braced himself for what was coming.
Is Princess, what's her name, your girlfriend now?
No, Michael said firmly. Absolutely not. Emma grinned.
You sure about that?
'Cause, of course, I'm not his girlfriend.
They both turned and saw the elf princess standing beside the corner of the keep, hands on her hips, glaring imperiously at Emma.
Oh, la, we are much more serious than that.
Gotcha,
Emma said, smiling broadly at her brother.
Now, Wilhelmina went on, I come with two messages. First, breakfast is ready. Second, there is black smoke in the valley. Apparently someone named Rourke has found you.
She clapped her hands.
So, I hope you're both hungry.
Chapter 16 For Auld Lang Syne. There was no time to talk, no time for Kate to ask Rafe how he had found her, how he'd disguised himself as Rourke. No time, for that matter, to ask why he'd come for her. After the glamour that had cast him as the giant, bald Irishman faded, and shouts and the thudding of boots sounded up from below, Rafe grabbed her hand and they raced up the stairs, through a door, and out onto the cold of the roof. The night air swept away the last of Kate's grogginess, and it was then, looking out at the untouched snow, with Rafe's hand still tight around hers, that she had a single moment of hesitation.
"What?" Rafe demanded. "What is it?"
What could she tell him? That she had just learned that the Dire Magnus, her enemy, was not one man, but many? That the new Dire Magnus was to be chosen that night, and he, the very boy now rescuing her, was next in line?
"We have to go!"
And she let herself be pulled away. As they came to the short wall that bounded the edge of the imp's mansion, Kate saw that the roof of the next house was a full story lower. She started to balk, but Rafe placed his hand around her waist and leaped. They fell and fell, landing in a thick cushion of snow, and Rafe was up instantly, pulling Kate to her feet, and they were off and running once again. The snow was high and heavy, and it was awkward for Kate in her new boots and dress, but Rafe kept urging her on, vaulting the short walls that separated the houses, weaving between the chimneys and the snow-banked summer gardens. They were halfway down the block when Kate glanced back and saw the figures of four imps charging after them.
"There, I know," Rafe said. "Keep running."
Kate could see the end of the block ahead, and past that the wide gap of the avenue. The wet snow dragged at her legs and dress, and she could hear the stamping footsteps of the imps closing in from behind.
"There!"
Rafe shouted. Kate looked to where he was pointing, ahead and to the left, and she saw the long, dark snake of the elevated train. The tracks ran along the avenue just below the tops of the houses. The train would be even with them in seconds, and Kate realized then what Rafe meant to do. But it was impossible. There was no way.
"Hurry!"
Rafe yelled. The first snow-capped train cars were already rattling past.
"We can't. It's going too fast. We just jump!"
Then they were at the end of the block. There was nowhere else to go. She could hear the rasping of an imp at her shoulder, and, holding Rafe's hand, she jumped. It was further than she'd thought, at least 7 feet between the edge of the building and the train. For a moment, they hung in the air. Kate could see the train moving below them, and she feared they would land in one of the gaps between the cars and fall down and be crushed. Instead, they hit dead center on the roof of the car, but the second they hit, her feet slipped on the snow. The boy's hand was ripped from hers. She landed hard on her hip, her momentum carrying her forward, and before Kate knew what was happening, she was sliding over the side of the train. Scrambling, she caught herself on a railing, so that she hung off the train, 40 feet in the air, as it tore down the avenue. She heard another heavy thump further down the train, and knew that at least one imp had also made the jump. She told herself she had to do something, pull herself up, break through a window, anything except hang there. But just then, the train jerked around a corner. One of Kate's hands slipped, and she swung out wide, dangling now by just 4 fingers. And she saw the street below her, the carriages, the horses, the people. And then the train straightened, and she swung back, slamming against the side of the car. She glanced up to see Rafe and the imp struggling atop the train, and then the train twisted again. She was losing her grip, finger by finger, and one of the bodies, she couldn't tell which, went flying past her. And the next thing she knew, someone had grabbed her wrist and was pulling her up.
"Are you okay?" Rafe asked. "Are you hurt?"
Kate shook her head. She was still stunned, still trying to understand. They were alone on top of the train. Rafe was kneeling before her, his hands on her arms.
"Scruggs gave me a glamour to sneak into the house. That's why I looked like Rourke, but I hadn't quite planned out the whole getting away part."
Kate began shaking and couldn't stop.
Why did you come back for me? Her hair had come loose and blew around her face, and she had to shout to be heard over the sound of the train. Why would you do that? Snow swirled past them. Buildings raced by. The boy looked at her, the lights in passing windows sweeping across his face. He took off his jacket and slipped it around her shoulders.
I'll tell you, he said. First, let's get somewhere safe.
Kate and the boy rode the train all the way downtown, getting off at a stop near the Bowery. Rafe didn't want to go back to the church. Not right away, he said, just in case the imps were following them somehow. Kate didn't argue, but by the time they got off, her hands were frozen into claws, and her forehead and ears ached from the cold. They had not spoken during the trip. It had been too difficult to make themselves heard over the constant rattling and the metal-on-metal shriek of the brakes every time the train turned a corner or came into a station. And besides, Kate had no idea what to say. For now that the immediate danger was past, she couldn't stop thinking about what she'd learned from the Dire Magnus and what it meant about Rafe. Was Rafe her enemy? How much did he know, and what was she supposed to do? Scruggs had said that the Atlas had brought her here for a reason. So, what was it? She felt confused and wished she could shut off her mind, but each time she looked at Rafe and met his eyes, she was reminded of how the Dire Magnus's milky eyes had glowed green at that last moment, and her thoughts began spinning all over again. As they came down the steps from the platform, Rafe said, "You'll need a longer jacket. That dress ain't exactly subtle." The clothing stalls were mostly closed or closing, it being New Year's Eve, but Rafe managed to buy a long wool coat that stretched nearly to Kate's knees, covering the white dress, as well as keeping her warm. Being in the Bowery, Kate felt an odd sense of coming full circle. This was where she'd arrived 2 days before, and now she was back, and with Rafe. She had the sense that things were nearing their end, but she still didn't know what she was supposed to be doing. As they walked along, Kate noticed, as she hadn't that first morning with Jake and Beatles, that nearly every other storefront was a saloon, or a theatre, or a dance hall. Loud laughter and music spilled out onto the street, and there were signs in the windows saying, "Celebrate the end of the century," and men and women staggered by with their arms around each other, singing. Rafe stopped in the middle of the street and looked around.
"In a couple hours, none of them will remember that such a thing as magic was ever real. Doesn't seem right, somehow, after all they've done to us."
Kate shivered and pulled her coat closer. The boy looked at her.
"You had anything to eat since lunch? You gotta be hungry."
He started to turn, but she took his arm.
"The reason you came for me, it's because you know me, right? The same way you recognized me that first day. How—"
"Don't worry, I'm gonna tell you. I promise."
There was a girl going between saloons with a tray filled with ears of hot sweet corn stuck onto tiny spears, and Rafe got one for each of them, which they ate as they walked through the maze of streets, making way for weaving bands of revelers. The corn was even better than the potato Kate had had with the boys that first day, and when she was finished, Rafe bought them a cup of steaming cider to share. They huddled near the cider man's cart, sipping the strong, spicy drink and passing the cup back and forth.
"Did you meet him?"
Kate looked at Rafe, but the boy had his face over the steaming mug. She knew who he meant, but asked anyway,
"Who?" "The man who runs the imps?"
Kate's own voice sounded hollow to her ears.
"Yes, I met him."
"What's his name?"
I don't know. They call him the Dire Magnus."
"Did he say anything about me?"
It seemed to Kate that the noise from the saloons and the theatres had died away, and all she could hear was the furious pounding of her heart.
"He never mentioned your name."
That, at least, wasn't a lie. But again, Kate felt like things were spinning out of her control and beyond her understanding. The boy nodded.
So you want to hear how I know you?
Yes.
Come on, then. I have to show you something.
They turned down the next street and passed through a dense warren of alleys, and Kate noticed more dwarves and a few gnomes and men and women in cloaks, and she realized they had entered the magic quarter. Then, on a narrow, nearly lightless street, Rafe led her down an alley next to a three-story tenement, and, stopping under the fire escape, leaped and grabbed hold of the ladder, pulling it down, along with a great cascade of snow, most of which landed on his head. Kate laughed. She couldn't help it.
"Yeah," the boy said, smiling. "Should have expected that."
He shook himself like a dog, the snow flying off him, though for a time afterward his dark hair was streaked with white, like an old man's. They climbed to the roof, and he led her to the side of the building that faced the street. He brushed the snow from the ledge so they could lean against the wall. The music and laughter from the saloons and dance halls sounded faint and far away. Rafe gestured.
"You see that building across the way? The window 3 stories up on the left. Watch. The light should go on in a minute."
Kate waited. It was cold on the roof, and she could feel the boy's shoulder pressed against her own.
"There," he said quietly,
and Kate felt that he'd been holding his breath, and only now let it out. She saw that the window was indeed illuminated, and an old woman was shuffling about a small apartment.
"That's where my mother and I lived. She moved us in a week after we landed in New York. I was just a baby. My dad had died. That was why we came.